You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to episode 446 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton,
and I'm Tristan Carcino.
Oh wow. Real vibe change. You sound like we're recording last night after the Seahawks game, which we aren't. But we are coming to you from separate locations. I am in Seattle, Washington, home of the four-time WNBA champion Storm.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, a city just southeast of Seattle.
Oh, no.
It is the Festivus edition of the Pelton Cast, and you want to know why?
Why?
I got a lot of problems with you people.
You know, Renton is still home of the... at one point CONCACAF Champions Cup champions Seattle Sounders. It's not just the Seahawks.
Cool.
Runner up in a lot of semifinals of a lot of tournaments, Seattle Sounders.
One full episode, all airing of grievances. Oops, all grievances on today's Pelton Cast. That is a promise I make to you. I promise to not speak positively about anything or anyone, including you and sometimes me.
I was going to say, you would be the challenge. We're getting this in just under the wire on Festivus. We had plans to record
Festivus
this earlier.
Festivus doesn't end.
Until you've
pinned me.
It's going to be very difficult to do virtually. I guess I can pin your video. But in the spirit of the flicker, in the spirit of... your power outage, your grievance today is first with your buddy who chewed you through your internet cable, and then second with the availability of internet and phone also at South Center.
Something happened at South Center. So first off, you said frankly, buddy. I'm frankly, clarifying, not buddy. It sounded like you might have said buddy, right? You might have had health on the mind, but bunny.
I'm pretty confident I said buddy.
This is back-to-back weekends that the bunny who lives in a cage has chewed the internet cord. I was like, we're reaching supervillain status for the bunny right now.
What do you call it? Spicy hay?
Spicy hay. He chopped, and it's the only cord, too, that when you like tug on it after it's bitten, it actually sparks. I was like, I wonder if it's a sexual thing for the bunny. And then I was what? The bunny died from autoerotic asphyxiation. Anyway,
grievances with this podcast already.
It's a funny SNL thing that people are talking about this week. That was last week we were explaining references. This week, no references will be explained. You either get them or you don't, people.
If we talk about whether the drones are manned or unmanned, you just got to understand it.
Anyway, all of South Center, so much of it without power. And I was thinking, this is probably the busiest shopping day of the year. I think this is a busier in-person shopping day than Black Friday, probably.
It's a great question.
Is it a great question? Because it was a statement, actually. But
but it was a
that's
statement.
That's my first grievance. You taking my statement as a question.
It was a statement to answer a question, which is what is actually the busiest shopping.
I think timing of the holiday season, I think people were sick of going out on Black Friday generally. And the timing of the holiday season was like, it all pointed to today.
That's correct. Apparently, everyone was at the South Center Costco.
Oh, yeah, literally. You said you heard this from me. I thought you heard this from somewhere else. It was backed up well into Renton, the line. And it was only for the Costco. Everywhere else was busy, but the Costco was busy.
All right. Well, do you have any other grievances to share, or should we get into it?
I'll be airing them throughout.
Of course. Well, we start with some sad news. We are grieving, but... I don't know that we have a specific grievance here. We were remembering Mariners legend Ricky Henderson, who died Friday at age 65. Henderson, obviously much better known for his time with the Oakland A's, New York Yankees, even the Blue Jays, but played 92 games for the Mariners during the 2000 season after being released by the Mets in mid-May and had 31 steals as the team reached the playoffs for the third time in franchise history. He started 5 playoff games, 4 of them wins in his final postseason appearance, and notably had a leadoff home run in his first Mariners start, which is a game I remember vividly because it was also the day of my senior prom.
Really?
And I remember listening to this while mowing our backyard that day. Ken Griffey Jr. released a statement calling it the hardest day probably of my professional career. Said Henderson was his favorite player growing up and fondly remembered sharing a glove with the fellow lefty during a game. The Mariners dug the footage up on this. This was 1994, Turn Back the Clock night, where they shared a left-handed glove and would leave it behind second base for the other to pick up between half innings.
So Ricky Henderson batted right and threw left. I don't think I realized that.
Yes, a very unorthodox combination. Brian, one of the Brian Hunters, also a bats right, throws left. So, yeah, I mean, Ricky, someone who, like, there are so many different forms of fandom on the Peltoncast Discord alone. And I feel like every form of fandom, Ricky Henderson hit that sweet spot.
Yep, absolutely. Ricky Henderson was awesome. I don't think I was paying attention to the Mariners by the time he was here that much, so I don't remember him as much as a Mariner, but mostly just a baseball player in the 90s. And he was somebody who was one of the important fixtures of baseball when we came up caring about it, and one of the reasons that you cared about sport.
Undoubtedly. All right, on happier note, congrats to Michael Penix Jr. on leading the Falcons to a 34-7 win over the New York Giants in his first career start on Sunday. And in a very relatable piece of news, Penix told reporters that he was at Costco with his girlfriend getting a hot dog when he got word Tuesday night that he would start. Was he part of the line at the Tukwila South Center?
Michael Penix, come on the pod. Keep it at 150.
Yeah, let's go.
We are willing to do episode 2 just for you, Michael Penix.
I mean, the beauty of it is the Costco hot dog, a multimillionaire, starting NFL quarterback, us. Everyone loves the $1.50 Costco hot dog.
The thing that people don't understand when they were like, oh my God, Michael Penix also, it's like, what is he supposed to eat? Like, Michael Penix has been a normal person for a lot of his life, right? I always think about that with celebrities, where it's like somebody, the line between ultra famous and just being able to go to the grocery store as an athlete is such a fine line, right? Like, I think Colt McCoy, you know, like Colt McCoy could just go to the fucking Costco and nobody's going to say anything.
In Austin?
I think there are a lot of places Colt McCoy could go. That's the other thing, is fame also requires popularity plus context a lot of the time. So Michael Penix Jr. going to the Costco anywhere that is not Seattle, Washington or Atlanta, Georgia, he could probably go.
Well, presumably he was in Atlanta, Georgia.
I know.
When he went.
I know. But also, like, there's a reality that, like, football players, I don't know. Like, should Michael Penix not want a $1.50 hot dog? Should he be eating $20 hot dogs? You know what I mean?
I mean, I do wonder, as a professional athlete, maybe avoid the hot dogs in general.
No, see, that's the other thing. Professional athletes, a lot of times, like, you hear DK Metcalf talking about his regimen. There's some people who are in the ultra fit world. And then there's DK Metcalf, athletes like that. He's like, I'm basically eating candy all day.
That is correct.
So there are many ways to be a professional athlete. And I think one of the most unifying things between athletes, celebrities, etc., is the love for the $1.50 hot dog plus drink from Costco.
Well, I heard, you know, the rumor is they're going to Pepsi.
They've been at Pepsi forever.
There's Are they going back to Coke then?
Where is this rumor?
I understand. I heard something about a change.
Hold on. Play the music.
Do we have music for Trader? I don't know why I keep calling it Trader.
Trader
Bros. Keep it at 150.
Bros. If anybody remembers that one.
Yeah, Coca-Cola products are coming back in 2025.
Oh my God.
There's your bonus. Keep it at 150.
This is the best news that has ever happened. I don't even have a grievance to air. In fact, the only grievance that I have on this Festivus is that it took you this long, because I have sucked down subpar Diet Pepsis from Costco for decades. Decades going back to, as far as I know, I only remember a time when Costco had Pepsi. I have to text Mrs. Fantasy Genius about this.
To allrecipes.com, it was 2013 when they moved
That's
to Pepsi.
All?
So I guess 2013? That is technically decades.
I remember it.
The 2010s and the 2020s. Those are two separate.
That's kind of wild, because I don't remember a time that it wasn't Pepsi. I wonder, is that all Costco's?
When I was frequenting the Costco food court on a more regular basis, it was Coke. So that doesn't surprise me. But I
Hold
don't
on.
know. Okay, we're gonna get live reaction from Mrs. Fantasy Genius. Is she gonna come down and come on the air?
I'm telling you, I've looked at that Diet Pepsi and been like, okay. I'm like, maybe just like a Sierra Mist, a little hint of Sierra Mist mixed in there. Let's see what she says. Wait, we've got the dots right now. I texted her all caps. Breaking. Costco is moving to Coke next year. She responded, praise the baby Jesus. It's a Christmas miracle, people.
Wow, it's a
It is.
Festivus miracle.
It is. It's another Festivus miracle.
Come on,
Wow.
man.
There we go.
Really gonna get this podcast out in the next hour or 40 minutes.
I'm so. Wow. I'm beside myself. Okay.
Breaking,
Okay. I'm going to
keeping
compose
150
myself
news.
again. Anyway, this has been Keeping It 150.
Have no idea what the like intro and outro we did on keeping it
Play the music.
150.
Play the music.
Well,
Costco doesn't even like really run ads, right? So it's not even like there's like a Costco jingle or
Costco
anything.
doesn't run ads. The wild thing is they don't even need to run ads. People just want to wear Kirkland Signature products as
No, we
advertisements for them because Kirkland Signature is fashion.
literally 2 nights ago. Are you aware of this information? Did Jan talk to you about this?
Not whatever information it is, I probably don't.
I was like, we'd just gone to the Garden Delights and at Bellevue Botanical Gardens. Beautiful, beautiful. $8, exactly the right price point for that. Don't go to Enchant. Fuck Enchant. This is my official re review of Enchant. Abso-fucking-lutely not. Only thing worse than Ichiro. But they play at the same park. Anyway.
Where?
And the good thing is about Enchant is they can start it early because the Mariners are never in the playoffs around that time period. But set up, especially during Ichiro's tenure. Anyway, we got home, I was talking to Jan, and I was like, oh my God, did you see the shirt that Kaelin got? And it was one of the Kirkland signatures because they don't always have those. They sell out fast. It was a Kirkland signature crew neck. And we talked
Well,
about this pants. Marco
someone was
has the sweatpants.
looking for them as a gift, a Christmas gift, and they were not available online. So, but Kaylin was able to get them in store.
Well, okay. There's a complicated thing. Who are you looking for them for?
Kaylin.
Oh, for her, you
Yeah.
were?
Yes.
Well, so there's three different types. There's the old school, the classic one with the blue and red. That one is just like that's gone right now. Then there's the all black one, and then they have a gray one also. So she got the all black one that they had in store, which it's not the same as the old school, the original. So the original is black, a black crew neck with the like Kirkland signature logo and the blue and red. But no, the brand identity is strong. I feel guilt sometimes about all of the other podcasts that we have that we just record so frequently, including Talk and Taco Time. I feel no guilt about our Costco podcast, me or Michael Penix. Congrats on the first win.
Really brought it all the way back around there at the end. Well, I was going to say there's going to be some music we're not going to be playing on this podcast. That's my transition as we keep it on the T-Mobile Park theme because Carlos Santana is not returning to the Mariners, choosing
Really?
instead to sign with the Cleveland Guardians on a 1-year, $12 million deal. You were unaware of this information?
Literally no idea. We knew he was returning somewhere.
I told you that there was like news that people were unhappy about
This
with
is
the
the news
Mariners.
that Carlos Santana, people are that concerned. I'm
I
sorry.
mean, the Mariners were concerned enough that according to Ken Rosenthal first reported this on The Athletic, who is very plugged into the Mariners organization, that they had offered him a 2-year deal with a player option for 2026 that would have guaranteed him more total money than the 1-year deal he took from the Guardians. He's played a long period of time in Cleveland. Recently sold his home there, so there's some familiarity and closer to home. Also, if you're guaranteeing him more money on a 2-year deal, by definition, what they're telling me is you were offering him less in 2025 than the Guardians offered him.
This is like no offense to Carlos Santana, who I always liked as a baseball player, but
Mariners
like,
hero, even though he the DCIM issues mean some of our podcasts can't be played on YouTube.
is that for real?
Yeah, those ones didn't clear.
That's actually hilarious. I think the Mariners are going to be fine without Carlos Santana. Like, his stats actually weren't bad last year, but if your expectation is that Carlos Santana
good.
Is going to repeat that at his age, I my fucking low system, I gotta get a new computer. But what is he, 37? Like, there is a certain point that Carlos Santana is probably going to age.
I mean, that point was during the 2022 season when he was on the Mariners.
Yes.
He wasn't very good then.
The other thing is, like, Carlos Santana may become available by trade during the season.
He will be 39.
Yeah.
So the reason that the Guardians had room to sign Carlos Santana is that they traded Josh Naylor. They did not trade him to the Mariners. He went to the Arizona Diamondbacks as part of a general thinning of the crowd at first base. Christian Walker signed a 3-year deal with the Astros. Paul Goldschmidt yep. signed a 1-year deal with the Yankees. So that leaves Pete Alonso and guys who already played first base for the Mariners in 2024.
Ty France.
And Justin Turner, who I think his return seems rather likely, although there are other teams still in the market for first baseman.
I mean, I don't know if I'm that convinced that Carlos Santana is necessarily going to be that much better than Justin Turner next year.
Did I say that he's going to be 39 in April?
Justin Turner?
Carlos Santana.
Yeah. I mean, they're about the same age, right? I think Turner might be even a little bit older.
They're very close. Turner has recently turned 40. Happy 40th to Justin Turner. So, yeah.
You're either too concerned with minutia right now, which I get, it's the off season, or
and the Mariners haven't transacted.
Exactly.
Amazingly, Jerry
DePoto. We need to be fed, Jerry. I don't even need to make the take. It's just still go back and listen to last week's. Nothing happened.
It was a hot take, but it was also a grievance. And Jerry listened to the pod and didn't do anything.
He went out and got a hot dog, though.
Well, then you'd have to listen to this week's pod for
it's fire. It's fire. He listened to the emergency pod we did.
Well, there you go. There's your Mariners offseason update. Ugh.
I mean, I would have been happy to have had Carlos Santana back, but I'm just going to throw this out there. I don't care at all.
Well, there are also some grievances to be had as we get into the roundup about the Seattle Kraken. Who's
oh, we're not talking
streak.
Cookies? We won't.
I don't think so. Okay. We'll save the cookie talk.
Well, never mind then.
We'll save the cookie talk for 2025. Kraken's losing
buddy.
Streak.
What is this, a meeting with a record label that I have to have?
The Kraken's losing streak stands at 5 after they completed a winless 3-game road trip with multi-goal losses at both Vegas and Colorado. They're home for the holidays before a quick trip up to Vancouver on Saturday. Kraken did make a trade since we last recorded this. Defenseman. You're aware?
I'm aware of this trade, and that's the first ever time they traded for a player that I'd heard of.
Oh, you've heard of? Okay. Defenseman Will Borgen plus 2025 third and sixth round picks to the Rangers on Wednesday for right winger Kaapo Kakko. Kakko, a native of Finland, Kakko was drafted number 2 overall by the Rangers in 2019. He played 330 games over 5-plus seasons in New York, peaking with 18 goals and 22 assists in 2022-23. Was actually averaging more points per 60 minutes this season with 10 assists and 30 games to the Rangers, albeit just 4 goals, but was a healthy scratch prior to the trade. Kakko will turn 24 in February on a 1-year, $2.4 million contract. Borgen was an inaugural member of the Kraken and also an impending free agent. So tell me, what's your scouting report here?
I don't really remember them that well, but like...
Oh, right. I forgot you were a lifelong Rangers fan.
Yeah. I think anytime... it's one of those things where it's like, oh yeah, it's Kakko. You know what I mean? Like, to know his individual like play, that was too far for me.
Right.
I know that the Rangers have fallen on very hard times, though. They basically need to blow up the entire roster. Anytime that you could trade for somebody who was the second pick in the draft, not that long ago, and is 23 years old, is probably a good decision. How about that?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that they should necessarily be giving up draft picks at this point, but they are not high draft picks, so we'll see what they can get out of him.
What pick?
Third and sixth.
Oh, yeah. Who cares?
Yeah, the six obviously is very inconsequential. All right, Seattle Sounders. The 2025 MLS schedule is out. They will open the season by hosting Charlotte FC on February 22nd. Expansion San Diego FC makes its first visit to Seattle on May 28th. They'll host the defending champion LA Galaxy in a Western Conference final rematch on September 13th, and then 3 days later, visit Miami for the first time in the Leo Messi era on September 16th. They'll then close out the regular season on October 4th by hosting the Timbers.
Did you just say that they start on February 2nd?
22nd.
22nd. Okay.
Yeah, we got a little time here, a little more time than that. Additionally, in Sounders news, Nico Moreno reported in Sounder at Heart confirmed the Sounders have agreed to bring back João Paulo. Is a free agent, undoubtedly a less lucrative, probably a short-term contract for João Paulo at this stage of his career, now that he's moved primarily into a bench role, but still nice to keep him on the roster and have some continuity and some reliable depth there. Well, a bigger move. No grievance here, I would say. Seattle Reign made a blockbuster trade last week, acquiring
really?
The NWSL. Yeah, you're finding out all sorts of new things on this podcast.
I know none of this information.
We'll see if you remember any of it. They acquired the NWSL's all-time leading goal scorer, forward Lynn Williams from Gotham City, with goalkeeper Cassie Miller in exchange for midfielder Jalen Howell, international roster spot, and allocation money. Lynn Williams has 80 career regular season goals, three ahead of Sam Kerr, the only other player with more than 65 in NWSL history. Also scored the opening goal in the 2023 NWSL Cup final against the Reign, winning her second NWSL title in that matchup. Williams has 75 caps and 24 goals for the USWNT, including one during last year's Olympics when she helped the USA win gold. Williams is age 31, so Sounders getting a bit older in the series of deals. They started out last year with Bethany Bolser, who's 27, traded her for Howell, who's 25 in August, but plenty of prime years left, you would think, for Lynn Williams. This is definitely not like the last stop for her, and unless it's an extended run with the Reign. So, I mean, this is a team that has not had that sort of big name, and particularly that USWNT fixture since losing Megan Rapinoe to retirement and both Rose Lavelle and Emily Sonnet to Gotham City, where they teamed up with Lynn Williams last year. But this year, the transact running in the opposite direction with Seattle getting a little star power from Gotham City.
And they finished third last year, Gotham City?
Yeah, they had a nice run, lost in the semifinals. So, they were a good team, but not sort of the juggernaut perhaps it might have looked like when the defending champions added Rose Lavelle and Emily Sonnet in free agency.
Were you familiar with Lynn Williams before this transact?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. I mean, I remember watching her with the national team. Like, for some reason, I don't think of her as notably in the NWSL, even though she's the all-time leading goal scorer. And I did not specifically remember that she had the goal against the Reign in the 2023 final, but it is an international player for sure.
And so most of those goals were scored with the Courage back in this chunk, like 17 to 21.
Yeah, after she started out in Western New York, won NWSL title there, had a bunch of goals in the two-game playoffs at that point. I think three goals in two games. And then they moved to North Carolina and became the Courage and were in the mix for many, many years, certainly before she went to Gotham City.
All right.
Yeah, no, this is good news. As for Cassie Miller, she figures to replace Laurel Ivory, who signed with Kansas City as a free agent on Friday, as the backup to Claudia Dickey between the posts. And around the same time as this move, the Reign bid farewell to Ziara King, who indicated on social media that she won't be returning. King started a career-high 18 games in her fourth and final season in Seattle, but the goal production wasn't there, just two in 1,337 minutes. Still perhaps a bit of a surprise that she's leaving, given King's wife, Jess Fishlock, remains on the Reign. All right, UW basketball. Let's start with the women. Xavier Sellers had 18 points and 5 assists. Tyra Ekai had 14 points and 11 boards to pace the Huskies on Wednesday as they beat North Dakota State 64-51, holding the Bison to 33% shooting. They then closed out the Husky Classic 2-0 by beating Furman 71-43 on Thursday afternoon. They led the Paladins 22-5 after one quarter and never looked back, limited Furman to 26% shooting, and had three players in double figures, led by a career-high 15 from freshman Devin Coppinger, who had scored 4 points in her previous four games combined. Coppinger breaking out really key production for a struggling UW bench that had not particularly been trusted by Tina Langley beforehand. They'll need that going into Big Ten play for real. That starts out on Saturday when they will make their first Big Ten road trip, heading to Northwestern for a very winnable matchup. The Wildcats started 1-3, went 7-4 in non-conference play. Now, it's interesting, they have played to the level of their competition to a high degree. They beat Utah, who you'll recall came into Heck Ed and beat the Huskies, and played Michigan tough in their Big Ten opener, but they eked past lowly Howard on Saturday at home and are ranked number 125 on barttorvik.com. So this is one the Huskies should be favored to win on the road. UW men's basketball.
Oh,
the news is not so
the
good.
The grievances are back. The grievances are back. Hello.
I mean, they played probably their best game of the season last Wednesday when they beat Washington State 89-71, moved up 13 spots in KenPom.
We don't care about that. This is
Festivus. And then Monday night, they lost in eight for the they had an 18-game winning streak against Seattle U snapped that had dated back over four decades to when Seattle U was previously in Division I before dropping down out of that level. This was shocking.
What happened? I mean, I was cooking during a bunch of this, so it was kind of on in the back. I didn't turn it on until halftime.
Well, I watched 0 seconds of this game, so you know more about it than I do.
It wasn't even that Seattle U hit threes, though. To lose a game by nine and your field goal or three, you hit more threes with a better field goal percentage. How the fuck do you do that against Seattle U? I mean, it looks like free throws is really the biggest difference, is CLU was constantly at the free throw line.
Wow, we went 29 of 32. I mean,
and nailed them all. But
so this, what, I mean, number one, the biggest surprising thing here was, like, last year, UW and Seattle, you played overtime at Climate Pledge Arena. That kind of made sense. It was a good Red Hawks team that won 23 games. They won the CBI championship. But Seattle, you coming into this game was 4-8 with two wins all season against Division I foes. So they did get a little healthier in this one. Kobe Williamson, who hadn't played all season as a senior front court option, made his season debut, played 16 minutes off the bench, but
4 points. Like,
Matthew Alexander Moncrief dominated this one with 23 points, 16 boards. He was 9 of 10 from the line.
What is the box score that somebody has where they, like, came in, they played a bunch of minutes and just put nothing on the board? What do you call that? There's
it's
like
called
a
trillion if you don't record any box score stats.
A trillion?
Yes.
Isn't there like a player who, like, very famously had?
Well, there's Club Trillion, was started by Ohio State walk-on Mark Titus.
Uh-huh.
Who
is there an
went
NBA
on to
one
podcast
on the, like,
for the
a
Ringer.
Famous NBA one?
The famous NBA trillion.
Anyway, Tyree Iheanacho, really close to that. Just the 19 minutes, did record two rebounds.
Two turnovers as well.
Two turnovers. Did not shoot a shot in 19 minutes. No assist. He participated in the game. I'm just throwing this out there. If I played 19 minutes in this basketball game, I probably would have had more turnovers. But that's about what my stat line would have looked like. I would have ended up with a rebound just randomly at some point. Like, the ball would have, I would have waited back and just gotten an easy rebound or something like that. But, and then every time anybody passed the ball, I would pass it to somebody else as fast as I humanly could. Me and Tyree Iheanacho, we have the same stat line on Festivus.
Tony Snell once had an 8 trillion where he played almost 9 minutes. I think that's what you're thinking of.
I think it is the Tony Snell one, yeah.
Yeah, that one got a lot of attention. Yeah. Yeah, this one's bad. I don't know what to tell you. This is pretty rough.
It's not just that it's pretty rough. It's that, it wasn't even great at Osabor in this game, right?
Yeah, he had 19 points, 7 of 8 shooting, 10 boards.
This was basically
their small front line.
This was closer to what we made. I mean, honestly, I thought that the Huskies were going to be good this year because I'm dumb, but there's a grievance for me. There you go.
you promised it was coming. Yeah, you know, they're starting three perimeter players combined for 7 points on 2 of 18 shooting. Or 3 of 18 is shooting, I should say. Let me not,
like,
shortchange them.
Some of the teams that Seattle U is behind in the WAC are teams that I am shocked are in the WAC.
I haven't looked at the WAC.
You want to try to guess them? Are you looking right now? How many WAC teams could ESPN senior writer Kevin Pelton name off the top of his head? Don't look. Okay, there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 teams in the WAC. because of course there are. Like, this is not the WAC we grew up with, which was actually kind of fun.
Yes, before the WAC became the Mountain West, okay, which I'm now gonna, has I'm become gonna... the Pac-12.
I'm gonna hold up fingers for each one that you get right.
Is New Mexico State still in the WAC?
Nope. Should I give you whammies? Should we do three whammies and then I'll tell you?
Oh no.
That's a whammy.
I believe there's a is Chicago State.
Oh, that's a double whammy.
No! I thought for sure they were in the WAC.
Two whammies. You can't even name a second team. I'm assuming we're giving you Seattle U.
Grand Canyon is still there, right?
There's one. There's one down.
Who else is in the WAC? there's one of the Utah directionals. Let's see. It's not Utah State, which is in the Mountain West. This is Utah Tech.
There we go. That's two.
Not technically a directional. I believe they renamed from something.
Oh, you're
now.
Three. I'll give you. You have a third of the WAC right now because Seattle U.
Boy, I know that there's schools from Texas in there.
I want to see if Luca's awake to play America's favorite fastest growing quiz sensation. Can you beat ESPN senior writer Kevin Pelton by naming teams in the WAC?
Maybe just do a TikTok video tomorrow with it.
It would get so many plays, and then people would hate both of you. Every comment would be like, this guy's an idiot.
Sam Houston State.
Oh, that's your triple whammy. Hold on. I'm going to go see if he's awake. Hold on. I just said, Luca, are you awake? And he said, yes, sir.
Oh, no.
And I said, come here. Come here.
Oh, boy. Yeah. I can see now who I was thinking of with some of these. There's a couple I probably should have remembered.
I need you to take the microphone. You've been called into action. But
you keep asking for them to be on the podcast every week. This is your chance.
You can't look at my computer, okay? So you have, because I have to be able to see my computer. So here, go like right here where you can talk into the microphone, but can't see the computer because I need to also. Okay, Luca, are you ready?
What am I doing? Wait, what do you want me to do?
Oh, this is great stuff.
I'm pulling the mic off. Here we go. I'm going to hand it to you.
This is
terrific
stuff.
Okay, Luca, we're playing America's fastest growing quiz sensation. Can you beat ESPN senior writer Kevin Pelton in naming teams in the WAC conference? WAC basketball. He got three.
Well, you only did you three misses. I heard.
What? Gonzaga's not in. We're not even counting them. They're in the West Coast Conference, dog. What's the WAC? Oh, I think you might. I think you might. No, give it a second. Think about it. All right, I'm going to give you the microphone.
You got to tell them the rules.
They're not the same conference.
There's three misses.
You get three misses, Luca.
I don't think he's going to get Utah Tech.
No, say the one you just said. Are they in the WAC or not? Answer me. No.
You have to say it into the podcast, into the microphone, or it can't be on the podcast.
What team did you just say?
Grand Canyon.
Grand Canyon is correct.
Wait, that was right?
Yes. You're at one.
Seattle U?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh my God, chill. Okay.
Okay, so you get three whammies. Can you hear me in the microphone over there, Kevin?
Yeah.
Very faintly.
Very faintly. You get three whammies. If you miss three, then you lose. You need to get one more time to ESPN senior writer Kevin Pelton without missing.
I mean, they get progressively harsher after those two.
I'm trying to think if the Big Sky has basketball.
The Big Sky does have basketball.
The Big Sky does have basketball.
Oh, well then. Come on.
You have any guesses?
Is San Francisco in the WAC?
Oh, God. Not in the WAC.
What am I supposed to do?
I think of all the teams.
Well, sorry.
When you think of West Coast basketball, are in the West Coast Conference.
Unless they're in the Big West.
All of the big ones are in the West Coast Conference. That's why we're asking you this question.
What do you mean all the big ones? Like Oregon State and Wazoo?
No.
What are you talking about? Yes, okay. Wait, so I got more than that.
No, they're not in the WAC. Okay.
Not in the WAC. Playing in the West Coast Conference this season.
Is Portland in the WAC?
Two whammies.
That's not true.
Yeah.
I disagree.
I didn't ask you down here to name West Coast Conference teams. Everybody can name those.
Yeah. That would not be a challenge.
Is there any that aren't in California?
There are a number that aren't in California.
Oh.
There's one that is in California. That's it. Most of them are in Texas.
How many do you have?
You have two. There's seven more. You need one more
to be out.
Or
Utah. I guess as many are as in Utah as Texas.
A lot in Texas and a lot in. I don't
know. Oh, I want to say. God damn it. What is the name? UTRGV? UT Rio Grande Valley?
Oh, that was a pretty good guess.
Is that
it's
not
a good
it?
Guess, but.
Okay, do you have any others you want to throw out there?
There's another Texas team. Is there another UT team?
There is another UT team.
You're close.
There's not another UT team?
No, there's a UT team in it.
UTRGV was in the WAC, but has now moved to the Southland Conference.
UTRGV is now in the Southland Conference.
Oh, well, sorry. Because I was...
Fucking idiot. Okay.
Wait, what? I'm not done yet.
You still have to guess the teams.
Yeah, I have more. I can't think of any.
Okay. Here, I'm going to read you the teams.
No.
And then you react to it.
No.
Guess?
Okay, let me think.
This is horrible content.
I don't care. Get your ass out of here.
I told.
Wait, is it team? Are they a UC team?
Are we never going to get the microphone back?
Okay. I took it back. Kevin was like, we could just do a TikTok video tomorrow. I was like, what is it, like Gut? like our boy Gut. But I was like, there's a person who's on TikTok. You dumb. Okay, do you want to hear? I want to record your reaction to the other team. So you lost to Kevin Pelton.
I know.
Okay. I'm gonna do them in order of easiness.
I can still beat him with Ultra.
I'm not actually. Okay. Abilene Obviously. Christian, come on.
That's not that easy, no.
None of them are easy. Southern Utah.
That's a school.
Utah Valley. Cal Baptist.
That's one I should have known, Cal Baptist.
You didn't know Cal Baptist was a school? You're fucking washed.
Taron Armstrong played there and was an NBA prospect.
You would have known when you were a little kid. You would have known their mascot.
I'm sure I would have, but I focused on other talents. Now I think you and Alan Cole.
The talents that you have are playing college football 25. Okay, I crushed you at Madden. UT Arlington, which is the one that you're. Okay, this is to me the hardest one. Tarleton State. What's their nickname? It's the state of Texas, and then there's something in it. And then the last one is a school that apparently exists named Utah Tech.
Oh, yeah, they just changed their name from Dixie State.
Correct, yeah,
so
it's Dixie
so they
State.
Used to, they, it's the first year called Utah Tech.
He's not completely washed.
It is
some
not
facts.
Their first year called Utah Tech. I believe they made that change last year.
Okay. All right, you're not staying on the pod.
Wow. Utah Tech, somehow in 2023... played not one but two of my girlfriend's alma maters.
Wow. Okay.
You don't neither do of which are any are remotely Division I.
All right. He says he only does football. Maybe tomorrow we'll challenge you two to.
I
can
name more
big sky teams now. Big sky teams.
All right. We'll worry about that later.
We'll deal with that later.
Let him go back to bed.
Okay. All right. Go to bed. Anyway, you can't stay down here. Anyway, that was a nice drop in, but she lost. No. Good night.
So, anyways, the Huskies should not have lost to Seattle U. Moral of the story.
Honestly, that was so much more entertaining than the entire game. UW versus Seattle U.
Seattle U lost to Eastern earlier this year in their season opener. They've lost to Cal Poly. They've lost at home to Illinois Chicago. They've lost to Utah.
We have to keep talking about this godforsaken team.
I mean, mean, there is some news about them, I suppose. They did play this one without Wilhelm Breidenbach, who was in concussion protocol.
That's why they lost to Seattle.
Hit his head during the game against Washington State. Percy Allen reported, I hadn't seen this, I still am not convinced until it actually happens, but that Frank Kepnong is expected to return in January, which would be certainly welcome for front court depth. And then the Huskies will add another player, French wing Dominique Diamond, whose commitment was reported by Draft Express over the summer, officially joined the team as a walk-on and has enrolled for the start of winter quarter. 6'7", 19-year-old, originally from Côte d'Ivoire, Diamond played for French club ADA Blois last season, primarily in the youth LNB Espoir, where he averaged 16 points and 6 rebounds per game.
I love that we could see your notes before the Seattle U game. I guess are these from last week, or did we just never go through these?
No, because we were supposed to record this morning and preview the game.
Oh, Highlanders are 2-11 and have not beaten any opponent ranked higher than 295.
Well, that's not about Seattle U. That's about the Huskies' next matchup.
Is it Western Kentucky?
No, the NJIT Highlanders.
Oh, Western Kentucky is the Hilltoppers, right?
That is correct. So the Huskies, if they lose this one, then Danny Sprinkle's on the hot seat.
Oh, wow. The hot seat. I think he's fine.
Again, if they lose to NJIT, he will be on the hot seat. They lost by 37 at Villanova in their only other top 100 matchup this season.
Ugh. I think, given the recruiting class, Danny Sprinkle is, can I steal from the Seahawks section? Sorry, the Seahawks end of your preview. It's obviously what we're going to say. The roster's a year away. You know what I mean? The way that Danny Sprinkle is recruiting is actually quite good. This is a transition year for me. I do think
people thought that, like, given what Danny Sprinkle did last year at Utah State with low expectations and a completely rebuilt roster, that he might be able to do the same thing at Washington. Yeah, no.
Maybe we learned that in all sports.
NJIT ranks 360th in offense, which raises the question, how many Division I teams are there? And I think the answer is 364.
We know that Tarleton State's one of them.
There is 364. Tarleton State, you know, not a bad team. 296.
Tarleton State -6 against UW at home.
NJIT, 355 overall in KenPom. So again, if the Huskies lose this game, disband the program. All right, UW football transact time.
Hello.
We got a lot of new transfer commitments. And a few new transfers out. Let's start with Arizona linebacker Jacob Mano.
Yes.
This I think, is the single biggest get for the Huskies, even if he's only got 1 year of eligibility and is coming off a season-ending knee injury in October. So it's unclear exactly when he'll be ready to return. But Mano was part of Jed Fish's first full recruiting class, was an all Pac-12 first-team pick in 2023 after recording 116 tackles and 6.5 sacks. Wasn't quite as productive last year in a different system, did not have a sack before that knee injury, but still someone, especially with the loss of Kamori House, who figures to play an integral role in this defense, whoever's coordinating it, since it's official, has been reported by many sources that Steve Belichick plans to join his dad, Bill, at North Carolina after the bowl game in a completely stunning turn of events to all of us. And to Kamori House, who had no idea that might happen when he committed to North Carolina.
What a happy coincidence.
Yeah, but you wanted Jacob Mano badly this whole time, so great to get him. Another linebacker committing to UW as a transfer, Xree Alexander, a player I was not familiar with, but I'm excited about because he's the brother of former Husky wide receiver Junior Alexander, likewise a Kennedy Catholic alum, and eventually we are going to get a Kennedy Catholic alum who actually works out at UW since Paul Arnold. Alexander played his freshman year at Idaho, was a freshman All-America pick, then transferred to Central Florida for one season, finished second on the Golden Knights in tackles behind one-time UW transfer commit Ethan Barr, and noted for his coverage ability. So those are probably your starting off-ball linebackers next season. We'll see if the Huskies add anyone else at that position because they still probably could use some depth. Also another transfer from Arizona, defensive lineman / edge, Taitai Uyangalale, another member of Fish's first recruiting class who emerged as a full-time starter in 2024, recording 8 tackles for loss and 2.5 sacks while splitting time between the interior defensive line and the edge. He is cousins with DJ Uyangalale.
Okay, they're cousins. Yeah, I wasn't sure about that one.
Yeah.
I thought it was a third brother. I was going to say, those brothers are just everywhere.
It does seem like it. Florida international safety C.J. Christian, who started his career at Iowa Central Community College, which could become more relevant, before playing 3 years at FIU. He has five career interceptions, had a career-high 79 tackles last season, and the second-best PFF defense on the grade per Christian Capel of on Montlake. So Huskies already added a safety transfer, now a couple of newcomers there in a position where they're losing their starters. And then lastly, USC tight end Cade Eldridge, native of Lyndon, Washington, who played only in the Holiday Bowl in 2023 as a freshman while redshirting, then had three catches for 19 yards last season in his redshirt freshman year and will have 3 years of eligibility remaining. All right, a couple of new players leaving the Huskies by submitting notifications of transfer. The big emotional one is cornerback Elijah Jackson, who we will always fondly remember, the SWAT.
Oh, absolutely. Love Elijah Jackson. So I was going to say, basically, Jacob Manu, look, there's a reality. We looked at the Arizona roster and said to ourselves, obviously, Jed Fish has these relationships. Some players who didn't even end up at Arizona have transferred here, and then a couple of players who did. And now the gem of the class is another cornerback who they need to try to go out and get. Should try to go out and get. But Takario Davis is next up on the list after Jacob Manu. Might even be ahead of Jacob Manu as far as attention, but that is where the money needs to go for UW, is basically Takario Davis steps in and you all of a sudden have a couple of former Arizona cornerbacks.
Was a bit of news. Should we shift over to that news?
Takario Davis would be a huge one to land. Agreed, right now, but for UW.
One of the things that may change that on the priority list is in the wake of the Diego Pavia's lawsuit and an injunction allowing him to play in the 2025 season while that lawsuit proceeds at Vanderbilt, the NCAA has granted blanket eligibility to anyone who would have had their final season of eligibility in 2024-25 academic year who spent time at the junior college ranks. And the most notable player that applies to on the UW roster is cornerback Thaddeus Dixon, who's one of the two guys who started ahead of Elijah Jackson last season. So yes. Now all of a sudden it's possible that Dixon and Ephesians Prysock could return as your boundary corners next season. Dixon certainly seemed to indicate some willingness to at the very least stay in the college ranks on social media after that was announced on Monday afternoon. So we'll be interesting to watch that and monitor it. But Jackson, you know, spent last season backing up, was in the rotation on the field at times, but not as key a role as he played in 2023. And even if Dixon doesn't come back, as you mentioned, a possible spot for the Huskies to add a transfer. So not necessarily surprising that Jackson looked to move on. Maybe a little more surprising with wide receiver Keith Reynolds, who's a redshirt freshman, had five catches for 35 yards, ran for a touchdown in an end around as part of the UW receiver depth, also served as a kick returner. They lose Giles Jackson and Jeremiah Hunter, two of their top three receivers, but Arizona transfer Kevin Green Jr. should be back in the mix and plenty of talented receivers in the 2025 recruiting class. So Reynolds may have felt some pressure from below on that one as well.
Here's an incredible thing that happened in college football that you would not have expected even before this season. One of the highest quarterback recruits in the transfer portal left, committed today. Are you aware of this?
No.
Cal quarterback Fernando Mendoza.
Okay,
right?
I saw that he was near the top of the rankings, yes.
Committing to Indiana. A quarterback going from Cal to Indiana and being like, wow, he made a huge leap.
He committed even after they played Notre Dame.
Oh, I mean, that's a massive spot now. Do the Curtis Rourke thing.
Absolutely.
Anyway, life comes at you fast. It is funny that, like, the alma mater, now it's like Indiana's QBU. All of a sudden, it's like first stop for Mike Penix.
I don't know if that really counts.
Should Kalen DeBoer have just stayed in Indiana and built there?
He was not the head coach there. All right, so we mentioned Kamori House is heading to North Carolina. A bunch of other transfer commitments as players seek to get settled before the holidays. Guard Memelar is heading to UCF. Kalei Tafai is heading to Minnesota, where he'll join Cam Davis. Lance Holtzclaw to Utah. Curly Reed going back home to Louisiana Tech. Brian Parham to UConn. And Tristan Dunn to Cal.
Okay.
where he will not presumably replace Fernando Mendoza. All right, Seahawks.
Ugh.
I mean, we really had the area of grievances about the Seahawks, in particular their fans, last week. Was it any better on Sunday?
Much better. Environment was great in the building. That wasn't... I mean, there were Vikings fans there, but it wasn't like as overwhelming as it was for Packers fans. And just hearing the people talk about the money that they made, honestly, there is nothing that I care about more than hearing, not to come back to this, but it was a thing that happened after we talked about that on the podcast, is people being like, oh, but the money was good. And I'm like, fuck you, actually. Like, good for you. Even the people who sat in front of us, they were like, did our seats get sold to Packers fans or Seattle? And it's just like, you don't need to ask the fucking question. I can tell you who the seats were sold to. You know what I mean? They asked us that and they were like, they paid really good for them. And I'm like, congrats on the money, dog. You know what I mean? Like, cool. Thank you for that. Anyway, environment was totally fine at the stadium. We don't need to talk about the crowd anymore. I posted the Mr. Feeney meme on, or whatever, clip on the Discord, which I thought was perfect for the moment. I was like, I can't post this on TikTok or anywhere because I do not want dialogue. You know what I mean? It's one of those things that you just don't need to deal with it. But I was like, this is so applicable. But I think it's more important to talk about the football on the field in this last one, because it was not affected by the crowd.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a very winnable game for the Seahawks. Like, you said that your takeaway was that, I don't know, that you weren't sold on the Vikings.
No, I'm sold on the Seahawks. That's the annoying thing about it. I mean, I guess maybe I'm more willing to overlook mistakes. And this was a UW thing also. To look at things more, to find the stats that are more positive for you, and overlook sometimes catastrophic mistakes that happen. And I think that's basically how you look at this game.
But enough about Geno Smith's entire season.
I mean, it kind of has been the entire season, but
it's been very weird.
I think he still had a good season.
He's not. It's weird because the things he has been good at are less obvious and maybe less individually important than the horrendous mistakes he's made, including probably two, maybe three in this game. There was one he got bailed out on the interception that could have been, that got dropped. Although I don't know, that might have been a receiver issue as well. But the first pick that he did throw, it was just like,
oh, awful.
There's nothing good that can possibly come in this play. I was surprised. My ESPN colleague Brady Henderson said he thought it was a bad throw rather than a bad decision. But part of the reason you have a bad throw is because you're rolling out at full speed to your right.
Yeah, no, it was both. It's a combination of both. It's a bad throw because of the bad. It was a bad decision to throw it, and you're going to make a bad throw because of the bad decision. You can't really parse the two out.
Exactly.
They're the same thing. It's like thunder and lightning. You know what I mean?
It's like if someone airballs a shot from 40 feet and you're like, well, it was a bad shot. And it's like, no, the likelihood of you airballing it is why it was a bad shot. Bad decision.
That one was pretty brutal. But if you looked at these stats, again, just on paper, 31-43, 314 yards, 3 touchdowns, 2 picks. You probably say to yourself, I'd probably take it. Right?
Yeah. I mean, the two picks, if you say one pick, it would have been different. I think.
Well, yeah, no shit. Two picks is twice as bad. One pick is very bad. Two picks is twice as bad.
But I think we should also like look at it.
Win the game with that happening.
Yeah, if he had had the second, if, you know, the Vikings just run out the clock, then he never throws the second pick and the game is over either way. So that wasn't as material to the game, I would say. Like, the Seahawks win probability when he threw that interception was already very low, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
I actually still thought there was a pretty good chance they got in a field goal range there.
I'd be interested. I guess I can go look up what Ben Baldwin's model had to say about it.
Maybe I'm being too much of a cockeyed optimist, but it just felt to me, after watching that game, and it's the same thing with the defense, right? Like, things are going well. In general, right? The amount of times that Minnesota punted, what do they punt?
I mean, the Seahawks outgained the Vikings by 1.2 yards per play. If you do that, you've usually win.
The Vikings punted 6 times in this game. Like, the defense, in the end, didn't do their job. But on the whole, they did fairly well overall. It's just these catastrophic mistakes. And again, it was very similar to UW losing road games. The more annoying thing about it is that it happens at home every fucking time for the Seahawks. So we have to sit there. And I think the home season is now concluded. And I think this was the worst home season of my entire time having season tickets. This was it.
Were you a season holder in 2009?
Remind me which season was 2009.
That's the Jim O'Moore season.
I definitely was. That was, my first season as a season ticket holder. And you know what? This was worse.
I guess that at least ended with a happy note. Because the Brett Favre game was 2008, we've determined.
I might have tickets then. I'm pretty sure it was. It might have been the year before the Jim O'Moore year. But this was worse than that. Because there's also another piece of it. Like, you end that season, what were they, 4-12 in the Jim Mora year?
Probably.
You can draft end that season. Yeah, with hope, right? Like, there's a carrot at the end of that stick. And you can say to yourself, like, we also were coming so recently off a pretty great run. And it wasn't as, like, we're kind of more in need of some wins as Seahawks fans than we probably realize right now. Like, yes, we had this amazing time period in the Pete Carroll, Russell Wilson, John Schneider era. But, like, now that's pretty well in the past, and the really good moments are fairly in the past. And it's kind of like there were some playoff, there were a lot of playoff appearances. Things were good. And, you know, like, they made the playoffs one time without Russell Wilson, but they got summarily crushed in the first round and kind of limped their way in. They had the COVID playoff game. Like, these things, it's just, they haven't had any great moments at home in kind of a long time. And then this year, they lost to the Giants. Are you aware of this information?
I am.
And it wasn't that they got unlucky and lost to the Giants. They got their asses kicked by the Giants. Offensively and defensively, the Giants crushed them in that game. So, and it really is, literally, you could point back to that one game and pinpoint it as the most important game of the season. All of them are important. That's the only one that you should have won, obviously, and didn't. It's frustrating because it was a JSN drop that probably cost them. And I think it was basically that point forward, that game after that, JSN became the best receiver on the team. And it's been fun seeing JSN become that dude. But, like,
that's been the single best part of the season.
I don't have answers for what they should do after this. I don't think anybody does. I don't think anybody knows what they should do. And it's, maybe it's like the Seahawks or like the Mariners. And it's kind of like, we could be upset that they didn't get Carlos Santana, but, like, statistically, they probably should just run it back and it'll be fine. But
I don't know that they should run it back.
Have a superstar young center fielder that is locked up for a long time. The Seahawks have players at important positions, but not quarterback. And so it's kind of like you end the season, we lost to all of your biggest rivals at home, right? There's basically no team that you would consider a rival of any kind that they beat at home. Their three wins were against Bo Nix in his first ever game, Skylar Thompson.
So I would consider him a rival.
I mean, but it's not. And it was before Bo Nix. Like, if they play that Broncos team in week 10, they probably lose to them. So, it was Bo Nix week 1. It was Skylar Thompson and it was Kyler Murray. And that was the only relatively good game that they played at home.
I mean, they did beat an NFC West foe and someone who we're now the world's biggest Cardinals fans. We'll get to that in a second.
But it was a pretty awful season all around. You know, like, the redeeming qualities. And the frustrating thing about it is things felt good in this game. It felt good.
Yeah.
And I kind of felt it was one of those things, like an old school feeling where you're like, we're just going to win. One way or another, we're going to win this game. And Geno throws that touchdown to AJ Barner, and it's like, let's freaking go. And then they sack Sam Darnold, and you get the face mask, and it's like, I knew what was coming because the previous time it happened, there was a penalty that kept a drive alive. Boom, touchdown to Justin Jefferson on the next play. And I could feel it in my bones that I was like, after that penalty, I was like, it's going to be a touchdown to Justin Jefferson. And then it happened right in front of us. So I,
you know, my grievance, Justin Jefferson had a monster day.
Uh-huh.
Both of my fantasy teams were amazing on Sunday in the consolation playoffs.
Great.
including the team that finished fifth, one spot out of the playoffs in the Pelton Cast Champions League, and would have knocked off Jimmer had I faced him.
Do you have any questions about, I don't know if this came up on the broadcast, should the Seahawks have gone to, and this isn't exactly what Devin Witherspoon does that well. They don't have a number one corner in that way. But, like, there were some moments where it's like, and I thought Josh Jobe on the whole did a pretty good job against Justin Jefferson. But was it like, at some point, like, let's just have Spoon follow him?
Yeah, that isn't what he does. That's the right way to think about it.
Is it basically just that that's not a thing Spoon can do? I mean, he probably,
I don't know, it's not a thing he can do, but he's not like, it's a, what is it, law of comparative advantage? The difference between Devin Witherspoon and Jobe or Rick Woolen in coverage is not nearly as large as the difference between Devin Witherspoon and whoever else you're going to have in the slot near the ball, you know, with the ability to make plays as a blitzer, that sort of thing. That's what makes Spoon a special player, not his coverage ability.
He's good in coverage, though.
But that's not what makes him a special player.
I understand, but like, it's,
you can't be a special player if you're bad in coverage. We saw that. we know how what that movie looks like. But just because you're a special player because of your versatility, it's like when people are like, why doesn't Giannis guard the other team's best player? And it's like, that's not actually what he does well. What he does well is protecting the rim and being a secondary, you know, defender.
I mean, it's a little, I think Jobe has been kind of a revelation for the Seahawks overall, right? Josh Jobe.
All things considered, yes. Trey Brown, not a revelation.
It was the offside. No, what? It was the offside.
Yeah,
you're lining
up offsides, yes.
And that's when they got the touchdown to Jefferson on the next play. Oh, that's the only thing to think. And when they sacked Sam Darnold, it really is like, you can pinpoint the Vikings were not going to win that game. That's it. If they don't get that, if Byron Murphy just sacks Sam Darnold and doesn't get the face mask, that's a Seahawks win. And that's what's frustrating about it. And obviously you can look at that like, oh, what if the Vikings intercept Geno Smith, then the Seahawks don't win the game. But it's like, oh, just so close. Like, I think the Seahawks, apples to apples, are a better team than the Vikings are after watching that game. I think they're a better team.
I don't agree with that. I mean, this is a game where I think maybe home field did help them.
How?
And maybe they match up well. Because
for the first time ever, home field mattered. The shit does. They're 3-9 at home.
They're 3-6. They only played
or whatever. Whatever. 3-6 at home. Like, today it mattered.
The
it
Vikings,
didn't matter.
Like, they're just better across the board. But what I would say is,
how,
like,
are they better across the board? What does that mean?
In terms of record and point differential and okay, all advanced stats, they're better across the board. The Seahawks are not a good team. They are an aggressively fine team. And sometimes they play better and sometimes they play worse because that's what average teams do. I think what we did learn is, like, there are some people who are like, well, why would it even matter if they made the playoffs? Like, obviously they can't win the Super Bowl, which is, I think, is very likely true despite the randomness in a one game setting. But the scenario, if you do win the NFC West, and which is the only way they're getting to the playoffs, is you would almost very likely host the Minnesota Vikings in the first round of the playoffs. And guess what? It turns out that is a very winnable matchup for the Seahawks.
Who is making this argument? The point of the game is to make the playoffs and try to win the Super Bowl. Like, I'm sorry, but you should be trying.
I mean, I think there are situations. You're the one who's, like, constantly been talking about, should the Storm have actually tried to be good this year? So I don't think you
don't
get to
exactly
get on your high
what
horse.
I was saying.
About
there
that.
Is a big difference, between NFL football and the WNBA.
There are many big differences, but the Seahawks would have a better chance of drafting a quarterback if they miss the playoffs than if they make it.
By 10 games, like, there's not that big of a difference in terms of draft pick between those. In fact, there's probably some evidence that being lower in the draft, like, the better the draft picks are or where the Seahawks are going to be picking. So I do not agree with that at all. Right? Statistically speaking, is it
quarterbacks? Quarterbacks are different.
And we have no evidence of quarterbacks in the range that they're going to be in. How many have been drafted there ever? Like,
well, I can think of one.
How about in the last, who?
Jordan Love.
But in the last, like, decade, how many quarterbacks have been drafted between 10 and 25? I mean, it's a few, but it's not that many.
I mean,
maybe 10.
Obviously, this has gone in a different direction than it once looked, but Deshaun Watson was drafted in that range. Patrick Mahomes was drafted in that range.
I don't know.
Best quarterback in football.
I think things are changing a little bit with regards to quarterbacks.
People are reacting to some of these. Mahomes is drafted 10th, precisely. But also, if you're looking to trade up into a higher pick, it's easier done from, 16th.
For who? For what?
I'm just, I think it's a fair argument. I don't think it's a ridiculous argument that the Seahawks are better off having a higher draft pick.
I do not agree with this argument at all.
It is kind of interesting.
Also, the thing is,
the Seahawks low-key through a Thursday's game, which is almost entirely irrelevant to their chances of making the playoffs? The scenarios where it matters whether they win on Thursday are if the Rams also win on Saturday, and then a bunch of miraculous things happen for the Seahawks to have a better strength of victory. The other scenario is the Rams tie the Cardinals, then the Seahawks need to win.
They shouldn't throw the game.
Obviously, they shouldn't throw the game.
It's a fun conversation to have, but it's not going to happen.
If there were any question about the long lingering effect of Geno Smith's knee, then they should throw Sam Howell out there and give everybody what they want. So the strength of victory tiebreaker, let's talk about that.
I'm trying to pull up some high level mock drafts because I just do not think there's a quarterback in that range.
That's funny. I talked to somebody the other day who was like, oh, people get so concerned about these mock drafts. And they were like, I was worried about the Seahawks winning and how it meant that they weren't going to be able to draft Jalen Carter. And then we didn't want them to draft Jalen Carter when he was out there and he went below the Seahawks. I don't know if you've met that guy.
There's a big difference. Big difference. It's so funny. There are many big differences in things between where they were picking and they're just not being quarterbacks. Okay, here we go. First round mock from Dane Brugler of The Athletic has Cam Ward.
Wasn't Bo Nix drafted in that range literally this year?
Well, where are the Seahawks going to be? We're not going to get the 12th pick.
But again, it's easier to trade to the 12th pick from the 16th pick or whatever it is than from the 22nd pick.
I mean, this has no other quarterbacks. Pick. This has quarterbacks 2 and 3, Cam Ward and Shadur. And then nobody after that.
That's too much certainty to apply this out. Having a better, higher draft pick is better for quarterback purposes. I'm sorry.
This is not the draft for that to matter. It isn't.
You never know which draft it is for that to matter.
Hold on. Okay, wait. The Ringer has... Did they do a multi-round mock draft, by the way? Shouts to Danny Kelly, of course.
I don't think they do at this point.
There's literally not a mock with a quarterback from
that's great.
Basically 2 or 3 to the end of the first round.
It's December. Things are going to change between now and April. So if the Seahawks and Rams both win this week,
I'm going to give you a maybe on that.
The only chance to win the division tiebreaker is to have a better strength of victory, which requires Arizona, Atlanta, Chicago, Denver, and Miami to finish with more total wins than Buffalo, Las Vegas, Minnesota, New Orleans, and San Francisco. Right now, the Rams are ahead on that tiebreaker. Their opponents that they've beaten, in the Seahawks' case, including Chicago, because they would have to beat the Bears for this to matter, have combined for 39 wins. The Seahawks have combined for 36. And just they're in much more favorable positions to win going forward, which is why if you look at the New York Times playoff simulator, it shows it is very unlikely for the Seahawks to win that tiebreaker. The Packers beating the Saints on Monday Night Football did help the Seahawks' chances to some degree. But really, we're rooting for the Arizona Cardinals this week. Because again, if the Cardinals win, it's irrelevant what happens to the Seahawks against the Bears. Seahawks-Rams will decide in Week 18, will decide the division title if the Cardinals beat the Rams. That game's on Saturday night.
Oh, it's been confirmed for Saturday night?
Yes. Those are pre-scheduled. Week 18 is the one where they have not yet announced what's on Saturday night.
PFF has a 3-round mock draft. They have 4 quarterbacks total in it, and one of them already has announced that he's going back to college and was picked 72 anyway. It's Drew Aller. It's Jalen Milroe in the second round. Maybe Milroe moves up to the first round, but do you want Jalen Milroe? Is he the quarterback?
I have no idea. I don't pay attention to college football. I've made it abundantly clear that I do not care about any college football that is not UW.
Wrong for that, but that's okay. Maybe this last weekend. The great weekend.
I was going to say.
But
I did watch a little bit of the Notre Dame Indiana game because there was
I was talking to Chris
on.
About it, and I was like, basically what this means is that by the time you get to the Final Four, it'll be the four best teams. And
I
in the
don't
college
think
football
that's
playoff
what it means.
Era, there's a good chance that it'll be the four best teams.
I think people are reading too much into a small sample size of games. And particularly a number of games that were played in cold weather locations. Like, it's not always going to be the case that the 5, 6, 7, and 8 seeds are going to be primarily in cold weather locations. Like, some SEC schools are going to be 5 through 8 most years. So,
I
some
wanted to
injury.
Bring up one other thing. Wait, before
Okay,
we get into the
back on
Seahawks.
The Vikings?
No, actually, this is back on Husky football. Maybe we do it at the end. Let's do it at the very end.
All right. So Zach Charbonnet, part of the reason that he didn't see very much action and part of the reason to see, like, so the Seahawks didn't run ball very much in this game. Mike McDonald explained on Monday in both the coach's show and his interview with the media that he wasn't, like, this wasn't a case where, you know, Ryan Grubb was just kept calling passes against his will. It was a combination of the way the Vikings, you know, generally defend and then some of the specific looks they got causing Geno to check out of runs to passes was part of why they passed so much. And that's one of the things that people never think about when they talk about, you know, why have the Seahawks abandoned the run that maybe they called a run and the quarterback audibled out of it or, you know, checked out of it based on specific reads. But that's not as bitches hate nuance. So. But Zach Charbonnet wasn't very involved. Mike McDonald said he was limited during the Vikings game, but signs are positive he could be a full go against Chicago, which I think would be good based on what we've seen from Zach Charbonnet this season.
I like Kenny McIntosh too.
Kenny McIntosh had some good moments for sure.
Yeah,
he,
no, when
he
Kenny
hits
McIntosh
the whole
was in there, we were in our RBSDM era. You know what I mean?
You're saying that running backs don't matter because the third string running back is good?
Yeah.
But also you're saying that running backs do matter because you'd prefer him carrying the ball to the starting running back.
Oh, I'm not a fan of the starting running back. But
I mean, Ken Walker the third had some
no,
good moments
fine.
Too.
He's fine. I like him. But I also like Kenny McIntosh. If all of a sudden it was like Kenny McIntosh is the Seahawks starter, I'd be like, okay. That does not change my perspective about whether the Seahawks will win this game. If we go into it, if let's say that the Rams lose this next week, Seahawks win or whatever, Seahawks irrelevant. If we go into week 18 and the Rams have lost to the Cardinals and it's like, it's Kenny McIntosh's job, my percentage chance of victory will not be affected by that one way or another.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Should we talk about the Bears?
Sure.
It's a Boxing Day showdown, Thursday night football. It's very amusing to see the Thursday night ads all featuring so much Bears. Like, people had high hopes for this game at the start of the season. People had high hopes for the Bears who they fired Shane Waldron on November 12th when they were 4-5, former Seahawks offensive coordinator. They then fired their head coach, Matt Eberflus, after a Thanksgiving Day loss in Detroit at 4-8. Passing game coordinator Thomas Brown replaced both on an interim basis, and they have since lost their last three games by a combined 60 points, dropping to 4-11 and extending their losing streak to 9 games. This team was 4-2.
This was a really like a careful what you wish for season. I feel like maybe the most in NFL history, and that's probably too long, it's the most that I remember in NFL history. Because in the past, firing people has kind of been a fairly good decision, I feel like.
Well, usually teams benefit from regression to the mean in those situations.
That has not happened. Like last year, like when the Bills fired Ken Dorsey, right? Like all the Bills offense has been much, I don't think Ken Dorsey's a bad coordinator, but like the Bills offense got way better after that. This one, the Bears completely tanked after firing Shane Waldron and then firing their head coach, just worse, right? Robert Saleh got fired. The team is just worse after that, right? Have either teams, the
yes,
Jets
the
have
Jets
won,
won
a
games
game.
Under Jeff Ulbrich. They,
okay.
Yeah, but I don't know if they've won. I think they have won more games under Jeff Ulbrich, but Saleh only coached like 4 games or something. Like they fired him very early in the season. So his winning percentage is much better than Jeff Ulbrich's. Yeah.
Did they fire him after the Halloween game?
No, way before that.
Are you sure about that?
They fired him after 5 weeks. It was 2-3. They have not won more games. They're 2-8 under Ulbrich.
Yeah. So all told, interim coaches. I guess did the Saints also fire their coach midseason?
No.
Who is the Saints coach? Dennis Allen still?
Yes.
No way. That
yes.
can't be right. Yeah, no, we
did get fired.
Derek Rizzi is their coach. Couldn't have come up with that one. But yeah, I feel like the Saints been better.
Has won more games than Dennis Allen did. 3-2 to 2-7. Didn't go great tonight. I mean, part of the reason this hasn't happened for the Bears, we'll get to this a little bit later, is their schedule. So when they went 4-2, they had faced like basically two teams that have a shot to make the playoffs, had played none of the other teams in the NFC North, which is the NFC's best division. If you look at since week 11, since they fired Waldron, basically, I think this is, their schedule since then is Packers, Lions twice, Vikings twice, 49ers. So their offense has probably played a little bit better, but their defense has played substantially worse because of the schedule they've played. They did beat the Rams in week 4. So Seahawks also have something at stake in terms of the common
losing,
common
right?
Opponents.
Do they? Is it better for the Seahawks if they lose this game?
Then they would not be, because if they win, they're also, the Bears are also one of their common opponents.
I see. Okay.
Yes.
That would be better than a draft pick.
That would be like 8D chess. Their offense mastered just 12 combined points in weeks 9 and 10 at the end of the Waldron era, which ended with a lot of shit being talked about Shane Waldron by pretty much everyone in Chicago, plus JSN. Well, I think JSN had some very valid concerns, I would say, about Shane Waldron,
even though
the offense was in general much better with Shane Waldron at the helm than Ryan Grubb, which is a conversation I guess we'll save for the Ben Baldwin pod.
It's so funny because I'm like, next year, Roma Dunze is going to have the JSN season. He's going to have the breakout season, right? And that both of them in their rookie years had Shane Waldron as their offensive coordinator.
But the other thing is, rookie wide receivers are bad. Like people see Justin Jefferson and they're like, oh, this is normal. This is what rookie wide receivers are supposed to be. They look at Malik Nabers and say that same thing. And like, no, that's not how it typically works. Even good wide receivers are usually not good as rookies.
Because do you know who is number 2 in receiving yards on the Chicago Bears?
I agree that Roma Dunze is having a solid season relative to the other Bears wide receivers, but I'm saying I don't think this idea that like Shane Waldron was holding him back. I don't believe that.
For Rome or for JSN? Because he was
for Rome. Yes, no,
he
JSN,
let JSN 100%. Run routes.
They used him as a gadget receiver. It was bizarre.
No, whatever Shane Waldron thought JSN is, he's not.
I mean, also they had more options because Tyler Lockett was still Tyler Lockett last season. In his defense, but they are 24th in offensive EPA per play overall. They were 25th under Waldron and 22nd since then, which is one spot behind the Seahawks. That they are last in defensive EPA per play since week 11 after being 5th through week 10. Caleb Williams ranks 28th in EPA plus CPOA composite. He's up to 20th since the coaching change. Solidly average in CPOE and a low interception rate. He's only throwing them on 1% of his passes, third lowest in the NFL. Those are the positives. The biggest issue is sacks. Only Deshaun Watson and Will Levis have taken them more frequently on a rate basis among qualifying quarterbacks, and Williams leads everyone in total sacks taken. He also just has not been the rushing threat, I think, that we expected in the NFL. He's 13th, according to QBR, in rush EPA among quarterbacks.
It still has a good chunk of yards. I would assume that...
I mean, maybe
yards
wise, he has fumbles.
Possibly, I would definitely guess that quarterback wise, he has to be up there.
Let me see if I can pull that information readily.
I mean, he's like 5th as a quarterback, right? It goes Lamar, Jaden Daniels, Jalen Hurts, Kyler, Josh Allen, Anthony Richardson, and then Caleb. So. He's at the tier right behind all of the elite rushing quarterbacks, basically.
Uh-huh.
Or maybe there's a tier that's just Lamar Jackson, and then...
Yeah, I mean, the answer is probably the fumbles. He's fumbled 8 times this season. I don't know if they count all of those against his rush EPA if they happen in the pocket, but that's probably a big factor in it. You mentioned the Bears' other wide receivers. Keenan Allen just hasn't been that dude, whether it's a Caleb issue, it's a scheme issue, or just his age. Career low 56% catch rate, has never been below 63% before the season, and just 6.3 yards per target, although he is still a red zone threat with a team high 7 touchdowns. Rome, as you mentioned, has been their most productive receiver on a per target basis, averaging 13.7 yards per reception to 11.2 for Allen and just 10 for DJ Moore, who, like, used to be a massive yards per reception guy, even last season when he was playing with Justin Fields was. So that's kind of confusing.
I'm not super sure on the fumbles because they list him as three. I assume those are the ones that get assigned to rushing, or is that like lost versus not lost or something? Know. But in ESPN rushing stats, it's three. And I mean, like, there's a ton of quarterbacks ahead of him. Maybe including basically all those running quarterbacks that we just talked about, including our fair Geno Smith, who has five. And does not have near the rushing yards. His yards per carry also are not bad. Like, I guess there's something that I'm missing in this.
Maybe it's a lot of yards in third and long situations that aren't converting.
Just picking up garbage yards. Yeah, I don't know. It seems to me, based upon just glancing at these stats, that he's been a better rusher than maybe.
Geno has fewer total fumbles, so I don't know if that is just assigning ones in the pocket.
Yeah.
Despite a low catch percentage, Rome is still averaging 7.4 yards per target. But the Bears have been more effective throwing to their tight end Cole Kmet and then DeAndre Swift out of the backfield. One thing Williams has not done is really helped out the rush game the way that we see a lot of mobile quarterbacks. Certainly we've seen that with Derrick Henry and Saquon Barkley this year benefiting from it, but the Bears are 26th in rush EPA per play. Defensively, they're 12th defending dropback, so still pretty good there, but 26th against the run. And like, if the Seahawks run game does not get going this weekend, I mean, I guess it did happen 2 weeks ago, so I can't say it's never going to happen, but there's never been a better chance of this.
The other thing is there's 2 weeks left in the season, so.
That's a fair point. They haven't allowed fewer than 106 rush yards since the bye. The Seahawks have only ran for more than 94 rushing yards once since their bye, so it is definitely stoppable force versus movable object. The other thing on their defense, they forced an average of 2.5 turnovers per game in their four wins, and their losses, it's one per game on average. So that's the recipe. If the Seahawks can take care of the football, they should win this game, whether we want them to or not.
Yep, sure. I wouldn't put percentage chance of victory at any higher than 50%.
Vegas would. Imagine. Seahawks 3.5-point favorites in this game.
Really? What kind of favorites are the Rams over the Cardinals?
That's a good question. Let me look that up.
And is that game is in Arizona, correct? No, it's in LA. Okay.
The Rams are 6-point favorites over the Cardinals. So, pretty crushing loss for the Cardinals in Carolina to end their playoff hopes last Sunday. Might have been better for the Seahawks had they had something to play for, although
a glimmer of hope.
I don't think that will necessarily prevent them from playing hard. Yeah, I mean, I would say slightly better than 50-50 odds. I guess like 55%. I should look at what the forecast is for Chicago, though.
I guess it's nice to know that it doesn't matter at all.
Probably.
In terms that it probably doesn't matter in terms of the playoffs. And we could focus all of our attention on Cardinals-Rams and just basically be cheering. That's on Saturday night.
Chicago, a positively balmy 44 degrees is the projection at kickoff time on Thursday night, although there is some chance of rain, and God forbid that the Seattle Seahawks of Seattle would have to play in the rain.
Well, most importantly, let's just cheer for the Cardinals, and this game doesn't matter at all.
Look, we are like
one
Cardinals
fans. I hope
there's
something to pay attention to in week 18, because that's what I'm saying, is like people cheering against them. It is so unfun to do this. The difference between the draft picks, this is not a type of situation where it's like, man, they could have had Bryce Harper or it was Steven Strasburg, right? If the Mariners had lost one game, that's not the situation that's going on here. This is maybe a couple of draft picks. Try to make the playoffs. Making the playoffs is fun. Making the playoffs is good, in fact, in almost every situation.
Wow. You started with a grievance and an all grievances pod, and yet you've come up with a positive here, which is making the playoffs.
No, my grievance is that the Mariners, the Seahawks are not going to make the playoffs.
Oh.
That they put themselves into this position to not make the playoffs, looking all the way back to the Giants game, but then also just not being able to stop one pass, a face mask, just do anything not to let Justin Jefferson score that touchdown. And then the subsequent drive after that, even in hindsight, looking at it, and the what was the official yardage on the Jason Myers field goal?
It was a 60-yard attempt, as I posted on Blue Sky, if you're not following us, peltoncast.bsky.social. At Lumen Field, since it opened, Seahawks kickers on attempts of 53 yards or longer are 2 of 13 all-time. Jason Myers, earlier this season against Miami, had the longest by a Seahawks kicker in Lumen Field history of 56 yards. And of course, that came in far different and better weather conditions than on Sunday.
I obviously this is with the benefit of hindsight. I was like, sure, line up, kick it, whatever. I wasn't expecting him to hit it, but you know, things happen. The punt was the right play there. And that's,
Let me look at what the fourth down bot said on that one. By the way, the Seahawks chances of winning when they got the ball or at the time of the Geno Smith interception were 11%.
Yeah, that's not bad. It definitely could have been lower.
The thing that everyone forgets is that before that, there was the false start on Abe Lucas that took their win probability down from 15% to 11%.
Just
no one ever remembers the false start.
So crushing.
It's been that kind of season.
I was there and I was like, this is going to determine whether Christmas is fun or not. Stupid football game.
Do you still think that?
Can't. Yeah.
I don't know.
There's just a little like feeling, right? A little inkling of we may not have anything to watch in week 8. This week may not matter. We know that this week doesn't matter for the Seahawks. Still won't care or whatever. Still going to cheer for the team to win. But that element of...
I mean, in terms of whether week 17 and week 18 matters, it does matter quite a bit, as it turns out.
It's huge. It is huge.
Because the Seahawks could get... There is a chance they could get eliminated with a win based on that strength of victory tiebreaker, but it's not likely. They would probably go into week 18 not knowing for sure. And then the NFL would probably schedule them on Saturday night for that game so that it couldn't be rendered meaningless.
It would have been very fun, right? That game, the game against the Rams would have been fun. And now we have to, I just hate having to rely on another team. The Cardinals aren't bad. It's not like we're relying on a horrible, not relying on the Jets to win a game, right? But the Cardinals can win that game.
The fourth down bot did say the field goal was the best choice in that situation, although they assessed a 42% probability of it being made. This is a change that Ben made earlier this season to deal with basically the Brandon Aubrey problem. But I think you probably, like if you were really, like the Seahawks internal model, I suspect one of the things they account for is the fact that it's so much less likely to make that field goal outdoors, particularly in a stadium as windy as Lumen Field tends to be. But they liked going for it more than punting, for the record.
I mean, I was also kind of like, well, 4th and 15.
I mean, it's a way longer play, but the situation I was thinking of was when in the 2013 NFC Championship game, the Seahawks sent Steven Hauschka, or were going to send Steven Hauschka out there, and then he told them during the timeout, it's too long, I can't make it, and Russell Wilson threw a touchdown to Jermaine Kearse that won the game.
That would have been nice.
Sadly, any other outcome does not play for the Seahawks anymore.
Sucks. But also, I mean, just the sack on first down, right? You're just feeling so good on that drive. That's just the Seahawks are marching downfield. You're like, we're in field goal range or close to field goal range. Like everything else is basically just money after this. Just keep going. And that sack on first down, just fucking devastating.
Yep. Yes, it was.
It's really the best, and it is also the worst thing that has ever been invented.
The Seahawks win probability dropped by 9 points on the sack. All right. Well,
got a lot of problems with you people.
I hope that the Seahawks loss has not ruined your holidays, whether you celebrate Christmas or Hanukkah or whatever else you use Festivus. Hope it's a happy and merry one, and an enjoyable one, and then we'll all sit down on Boxing Day. And I mean, I actually won't watch the Seahawks game because I'm going to be at the Blazers game that night.
I'm going to be at the Blazers game opposite the Rams Cardinals game.
Yes, I may also be at that. We'll TBD on that one, but we will both be in Portland simultaneously. So maybe we'll talk Portland food next week. We'll be coming to you. The plan is next Sunday night, but we'll see how
that's
that
always
goes.
The plan. Always the plan is next
it
Sunday
was
night.
The plan last time, this week as well.
Well, the game that matters is on Saturday, so Sunday's going to really not matter all that much.
Exactly. Well, unless it matters a lot for the strength of the victory tiebreaker. On
I'm
that
not
note,
holding my breath on that one, but
me neither.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
Did you see this in the Discord from Sean Kramer?
Which one?
He calculated what UW would have looked like in the college football playoff system dating back. So 2016, obviously, they would have been the four seed with a bye winner of Penn State versus Western Michigan in that one. 2017, this obviously his projections, like nobody's done this, but I'm sure it's pretty accurate. UW would have been an 11 seed playing against the other UW at Wisconsin. There's no chance they win that game.
We know what it looks like when Seattle teams go to Wisconsin to play in the winter.
In December also. 2018, number 9 seed UW at UCF, the win to play Bama. That would have been a very fun one. That UCF team was also a really fun team, right? That was the Shaq Griffin team that went undefeated, I think, right?
That sounds right.
And then won their bowl game as well. 2022, obviously 19, 2021 out. 2022, first team out to make room for the G5 bid Tulane, which is funny because I've thought about this particular team, and I think they finished 11th, I want to say. They kind of remind me of the Arizona team from last year. But it was one of those teams where it's like, oh, if they just won one more game, I felt like we would have been in playoff conversation. So this is the kind of team that the 12-team playoff is really fun for, when you can like basically like not sneak your way in, but a couple of losses don't just end your season. And then 2023 would have been the 2 seed, gotten the bye, played the winner of Ohio State, Penn State. So maybe they don't go to the national championship. that's kind of what I was saying about the basically like Ohio State a lot of times has been this team, but the team who's actually probably better than somebody who's in the playoffs and or is back when it's a 4-team playoff. And it's those teams who are like, or like Georgia last year, right? Like, honestly, in a one game, you probably give me Georgia against any of the teams of the 4 teams that were in the college football playoff last year. And I feel like they probably are going to win, including Alabama, who they just lost to. Like, if they play again, I still am taking Georgia in that game. I bet the spread is something like Georgia -5, -6. Michigan, maybe. I don't know. But looking back at that, in this era, basically 2016 onward, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times making the college football playoff. Like, that's definitely up there with one of the best programs in the country.
Yep.
During that time period, you're basically like in the echelon of, there are a few teams who would have made it almost every year, right? Like Bama, it's like Bama, Georgia, Oklahoma, Ohio State's making it. And I feel like Penn State is one of those teams that if you go to 12 teams, it's just like, they're automatic to be, they're going to either host a bunch of playoff games, or they're going to end up playing in a bunch of the first round games going at somebody. Texas is probably still ahead of it. The team down south is in that same mix, but it's like, and then Oklahoma on the earlier side of the playoff era was much better, but it's kind of like, and then Michigan had their run under Jim Harbaugh, which is probably about the same, but like, it's kind of interesting that that's the class of college football during this time period. Maybe Florida State ends up making, I don't remember, but, and Clemson also. Clemson definitely would have been in there in ton. But yeah. That's it. Like, if you basically took 10 teams in that era who would have gone to the playoffs that many times, like UW is one of those 10 teams, which is kind of wild, all things considered, that a lot of people basically view it as like a stepping stone program. And it's just like, I don't, to what, you know, like, yes, there are teams that are bigger and better, but that have a like decade long history now built up that UW has of being competitive on the national level. So it's a pretty interesting thing.
Something to look to keep going. in the Sun Bowl.
I mean, I'm happy that Sean Kramer did this because I've thought about this before, basically what it would have looked like. And I mean, I don't know if they win any of these games. That's the thing where it's like maybe in 2016, they beat Penn State. They probably beat Central Florida going on the road at Central Florida in 2018. They probably beat Central Florida. Maybe, I don't know. And then get crushed by Bama. The 22 team is the team that I'm like, I feel like was more unstoppable. That's always the way it is, that the year before you're always kind of like more unstoppable, but I would have taken that team over maybe even the 2023 team in some ways.
I don't agree with that.
At that point, they were pretty dominant at the end of that season. The 2022 team at the end of the season was more dominant than, I don't know, I guess some of their last games were beating Oregon and beating Texas.
Right.
They just had so many close games in 2023 that they didn't in 2022 near the end. Wazoo would have been first team out in 2018. How strange. Anyway, it's an interesting thing to look back on and kind of the program that's been built, how lucky we've been during this time period.
Absolutely.